out of a painting is what it seemed like to me. They were stunning. And I really am honored to be here tonight, and I wanted to acknowledge Norman for giving me this opportunity and for all of you for showing up. It's strange and wonderful to sit here. And I also want to thank Norman for letting me speak on Earth Day. As many of you know, before I turned to visual art, I did a lot of work in environmental conservation, and I had the great privilege towards the end of my career there, although I'm still working on some projects, to witness environmental restoration, landscape restoration, as an actual phenomenon that our culture is capable of. Obviously, we're not the first, but it's been an incredible journey to witness that. So it's been interesting, and I've been thinking about this talk, trying to honor Earth Day and combine what we're learning from Suzuki Roshi and from Ashwagosa into one talk. So we'll see how it goes. But I do want to also, I keep honoring Norman, but I appreciate that we're working with both of these texts. At first I thought, wow, this is going to be a little inelegant. But you know, what we've got is this wonderful, seemingly simple text from Suzuki Roshi that really points to a lot of deeper truths, and a seemingly convoluted, complex, pithy text from Ashwagosa that is actually quite simple in what it's saying. And so there's this wonderful weaving that's happening, and I didn't necessarily think that was possible. I thought it'd be more like ping pong, so. So the teaching that I'd like to focus on tonight comes from the Suzuki Roshi book. It's on page 22. And he says, only when A is A, only when we are satisfied with ourselves as A or as I, is there a chance to have renunciation, a chance to vanish. If A could be something else, then A might be a permanent being. But no such permanent being exists. Only when A is just A is it possible for A to vanish. At first, I was extremely confused by this. What does it mean if A could be something else, then A might be a permanent being, but no such permanent being exists? I think the key to understanding this, at least for me, lies in the words permanent being. We know that all beings are contingent and constantly changing. We cannot just become something else under our own volition, much as we think we are doing it under our own volition. We are bound and enmeshed and brought into being in an intricate web of causes and conditions. And so it's important that we acknowledge who we are in this very moment, right now, with all of our fears and hopes and cravings. That is A. That is who we are right now. Okay, so far so good. We can locate ourselves in the here and now. We can find ourselves that way. But then Suzuki Roshi says something strange. Only when A is just A is it possible for A to vanish. To me, Suzuki Roshi seems to be saying we can vanish the hard way by clinging to the notion of a fixed self, or we can vanish in a more harmonious way by becoming who we really are and at the same time allowing the world to move through us. At first, we might locate ourselves by feeling how we move through the world, our history, our credentials, our fixed opinions. But then slowly, over time, we begin to see how really it is the world moving through us. This is what Suzuki Roshi seems to be pointing to. And Dogen said as much in his text on unwholesome action that we studied last month in Dharma seminar. Dogen says, when you move mountains, rivers, and earth, as well as the sun, the moon, and stars to practice, they in turn move you to practice. It's a wonderful notion on this Earth Day to consider that. Just as the tagline for Every Day Zen says, we are turning and being turned by the world. To turn and be turned by the world, and then to disappear when the time is right. We become ourselves so we can let go of ourselves and be with what is happening right now. And this idea, this phenomenon, this feeling makes me think of the last big landscape restoration project that I worked on. I was part of a team helping to restore the Cargill salt ponds in the South Bay. And I worked on that project with Mary Selkirk, who's a member of the Sangha. I don't know if she's online tonight. But for those who don't know, the Cargill salt ponds are those strange colored ponds that sit, that you fly over if you have flown into San Francisco Airport. And it, this 15,000 acre site of industrial salt production was once a tidal wetland that was used by thousands of migrating shorebirds along the Pacific Flyway, which runs from Alaska to Argentina and carries through a series of very fractured landscapes, shorebirds migrating every twice a year, coming down and going back. Tidal wetlands and their mudflats are a really rich resource, as most of us know. They make some of the most productive ecosystems on Earth, and they also act like a sponge buffering landscapes along the bay from the effects of climate change and coastal flooding. Unfortunately, California has lost about 80% of its coastal wetlands to filling and to development. And with that loss has come a dramatic decline in bird species and an increase in storm surges, as we've all seen, and flooding around the bay. So when Cargill decided to sell the property in 2005, it was a really big deal. And we began a 50-year project to open up the levees and start restoring the landscape to tidal marsh. And each of our small steps toward restoration was a cause for celebration. We'd set out chairs on the levees and invite the press. Sometimes we had news helicopters flying around. And then everyone would cheer as a giant backhoe would cut through an earthen levee and the tide would just come spilling onto this dry, parched landscape. And once bay water crosses a landscape, it begins a process of transformation. A parched, salty set of dry ponds separated from the bay for decades is reconnected with the dynamic, nutrient-rich flow of the bay. Species come back, mudflats come back. And sometimes I feel like becoming ourselves is a bit like this. Our natural goodness and connectedness, it's been there all along. But we've built up levees, some habits of mind, some psychology, some stories that keep us isolated, fearful, uncertain. But our true self is like the life-giving water of the ocean and the bay. It's been here. It's waiting for us. A lot of planning and scientific evaluation and public meetings went into the development of the restoration plan. But in the end, it came down to just breaking through a couple of levees. It was that simple. A few barriers. The water, the bay was always there. And we were the ones who had changed. We decided it was better to restore the area to a state of flow, to a state of tidal action, better to allow the water in, and begin that process of creating a wetland than to continue to maintain an isolated industrial salt pond. Ashvaghosha underscores this idea, I think, in The Awakening of Mind when he writes, this is on page 37, the process of actualization of enlightenment is none other than the process of integrating the identity with original enlightenment. And this is the same quote that Norman referenced last week. And I agree with him. I think it is perhaps the pithiest part of this pithy little book. Integrating identity with original enlightenment. I think this practice of becoming ourselves is kind of a personal landscape restoration. We work to acknowledge all the personal constructions and barriers that we've created, our stories and our cravings. And as Suzuki Roshi says, we let A be truly A. And with practice, we begin to hold these constructions more lightly. Gradually, the waters of original enlightenment return to our landscape. We find the water has been there all along, and we can relax and let it in. We celebrate. Just as we did at the South Bay Salt Ponds, at the news conferences, our Sangha celebrates each of our small steps towards personal restoration in the Dharma. We get dressed up, we put out chairs, we have a ceremony. Maybe we don't have news helicopters flying overhead, but maybe we should. Each of these small steps toward restoration is a cause for celebration. And we acknowledge also that it's a long process that we are dedicating ourselves to. When I left the Salt Pond Restoration Project, they still had 25 more years to go, but it's happening. And I was gonna mention that our celebrations continue because even this weekend, we're gonna have our spring Jukai ceremony. It'll be a great celebration. As poet Mary Oliver would say, this return to nature, our true nature, allows us to vanish in ways that we can't even fathom. This is her poem, Sleeping in the Forest. I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed, nothing between me and the white fire of the stars, but my thoughts. And they floated light as moths among the branches of the perfect trees. All night I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night I rose and fell as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning, I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better. I'll repeat that last part. All night I rose and fell as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning, I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better. Only when A is just A is it possible for A to vanish. That's the idea, and it's a beautiful metaphor. But as we all know, it's not that easy. It takes practice. And two particular aspects of practice I wanted to mention tonight because they're also very important to Suzuki Roshi. First, Zazen, and then Sangha, practicing with others. So first, Zazen. My experience with sitting Zazen, changes day to day, as I'm sure it does for you. But I know that over the years, a certain steadiness has grown. One of the keys to unlocking the door to the true self is recognizing our own habits of mind. And as we know, to do this, it's helpful to be cognizant of the difference between observing self and managing self, or observing mind and managing mind. This is a quote from Suzuki Roshi on page 36. Buddha nature is not small self, it is big self, which is observing what you do, always accepting what you do. Whatever you do, Buddha nature will say, ah, that's good. There is nothing wrong with it. Enlightenment is always to be aware of that true nature. I think he's underscoring a key to cultivating our big self or observing self. We need to be kind, but firm. On the cushion during Zazen over the years, I feel like I've become a little more adept at recognizing when I'm caught by something, a little more nuanced in noticing habits of mind. And as I'm sure you've experienced, this sense of returning to a deep centeredness can follow me off the cushion. It's basic mindfulness, after all. But as we all know, it takes practice and it takes discipline. And this is helpful because, at least for me, the urge and habit to get tangled in my small managing self is so strong. I find this when I return home to help my aging parents. It's hard to be attentive and really listen and observe when my managing self senses a crisis unfolding at home. But if my managing self had its way all the time, everything around me would be a potential crisis. Everything would be on fire. Slowly, over time, I think I keep saying that, slowly, over time, that is my experience, I'm learning to observe my need to fix and to manage things. Sometimes my fixing impulse is helpful, and sometimes it's not. And this observing self helps me figure out the difference. When A is truly A, I have some perspective on a situation without judgment. I remember after practicing with Everyday Zen for a few years, I did Sesshin and I participated in the formal Soshan ceremony, wonderful ceremony at the end of Sesshin, where everyone gets to ask Norman a question related to their own practice. And I asked Norman why we needed to meet with other people at all in the Sangha. If all the teachings were available to me and I could sit Zazen, what was the point of Dokusan? It was a true expression of my understanding of practice at the time. I didn't know that we could only become ourselves and express the Dharma through our relationships with each other. Of course, Norman didn't exactly explain it that way to me during the ceremony. Instead, it was more like me. What is the point of Dokusan, Norman? Just come hang out, boom, stick down, end of story. Perfect. But over the years, I did come hang out. I did start to talk to other people in the Sangha. I began to see that none of this practice happens without engaging with others, even for introverts like me. We are bound to others. They help us to find ourselves. Because when we truly become ourselves, we realize they are us and we are them. And speaking of Sangha, last year, a friend texted me this news clip from an Arizona newspaper that I wanted to share with you. The headline reads, "Missing Woman, Mystery Solved." A group of tourists spent hours Saturday night looking for a missing woman near Iceland's Elgja Canyon, only to find her among the search party. The group was traveling through Iceland on a tour bus and stopped near a volcanic canyon. Soon there was word of a missing passenger. The woman, who had changed clothes, did not recognize the description of herself and joined in the search. But the search was called off about 3 a.m. when it became clear that the missing woman was in fact accounted for and searching for herself. I'm so glad I kept that because I had no idea we'd be reading this. And one of the many things I love about this piece is the way that it points to our capacity to find ourselves within the context of a group. We get caught up in the drama of the search. There is excitement that maybe someone or something is missing. Maybe we're not enough. We read Suzuki Roshi's book, and then we realize, like the tide, our true nature, our true self, has been here all along. We just changed our clothes. How silly we can be in our striving, and I've been there. On the other hand, we all know the power of the group for good and for evil. The more we look outside of ourselves for answers, the more we rely on the group, and a sort of sneaky comparing mind can slip in to our worldview. And I've experienced this in my art practice and in my spiritual practice. Maybe you have too. I ask myself, what is my place here? Do I belong in this Sangha? Am I really an artist? Who am I? Should I be doing it the way that he's doing it, Maybe they or she has the right way to practice. Kjogen Carlson addresses this question in the group head on in his wonderful book, You Are Still Here. He says, eventually, you just see how irrelevant comparison is. People will awaken in ways that I cannot. I don't want to practice their way. I don't have to resent it. When I simply do my own training and have no opposition to others, the way others awaken and practice suddenly becomes my experience. So when we understand that Sangha is here to hold a container for us, to support us, we can turn our light inward and relax into our own experience of practice. Then we can learn about who we truly are. So it can be tricky, this business of becoming ourselves. We're all just trying to let A be A so that we can vanish. But at the same time, we have all these levies and constructions about who we think we are or need to be. Fortunately, Zazen and Sangha do help us find ourselves. We do this for each other by holding the silence in Zazen, by chanting and bowing together, and by talking with each other in small groups and in Dokusan and in practice discussion. We witness each other as we wade into this process of trying to integrate our identity with the waters of our own original enlightenment. We splash around together, we get wet, and little by little, we open up our barriers. We let the great tide of the Dharma transform us. I think the earth needs and wants us to practice this way. Thank you. We have, I think, 5 minutes until we're going to shift into ceremony mode. Does anyone have a comment or a question? Okay.
Will you read the clipping again?
Sure. It's so good. I wonder if it's real, but she did send it to me, so. Right? Yes, she lives in Arizona and is a Dharma practitioner, so. The headline reads, Missing Woman, Mystery Solved. A group of tourists spent hours Saturday night looking for a missing woman near Iceland's Elgja Canyon, only to find her among the search party. The group was traveling through Iceland on a tour bus and stopped near a volcanic canyon. Soon, there was word of a missing passenger. The woman, who had changed clothes, did not recognize the description of herself and joined in the search. But the search was called off about 3 a.m. when it became clear the missing woman was in fact accounted for and searching for herself. There it is. Any other comments or questions before we shift? Well, thank you very much. Okay. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.